You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. Join me as we uncover the rich histories of North America's Great Plains, exploring the latest archaeological discoveries and past cultures that shaped this storied region. Welcome to the podcast. Welcome to episode 32 of the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. I am your host, Professor Carlton Shieldchief-Gover, and I am just absolutely thrilled to have you join me on this exciting journey through the rich and fascinating histories of North America's Great Plains. Tonight, I am very excited because we are joined by Amy Gillespie, archaeologist for Archaeology Southwest, and is the BIA, Bureau of Indian Affairs, NAGPRA Assistance Program Coordinator. But tonight, we're not talking about NAGPRA. We're not talking about Southwest Archaeology. We are talking about the Jones Miller Bison Bone Bed Kill Site in Ray, Colorado, damn near Kansas, Colorado, a site that both me and Amy worked on at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science. Amy, thank you so much for joining me this evening. How are you doing today?
I am doing great. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I am too. When I was looking at guests and like brainstorming guests and like different sites, I was like, I gotta have Amy to come on and talk about Jones Miller, because that was such a pivotal time in my academic career of like a quasi postdoc at Denver Museum of Nature and Science working on this site. And we are continuing to work on it and get it published. But so if fun times, you know, ever since I've kind of joked with my colleagues, I keep working at Denver Museum was probably like the highlight of museum facilities, and every job I take after the quality of the infrastructure is less and less going away from it. But so real quick, could you just like introduce yourself to the audience real quick?
Yeah, absolutely. So as Carlton said, my name is Amy Gillespie. I use she, they pronouns, and I am an archaeologist, but I have a wide variety of experience working as a museum professional. I do work in NAGPRA now, as we mentioned earlier. I do a lot of work with volunteers. I volunteer coordinate for International Archaeology Day in Denver, Colorado. So I do a little bit of everything, and yeah, I'm excited. It was an interesting time in my career as well. I had just graduated in the height of the pandemic with my master's degree. So we were both at really pivotal points in our careers and our lives when we met.
That's right. We were wearing masks. It was the mask times. It was the mask times. That's right. That was good Lord. Well, excellent. So Amy, real quick. So what is the Jones Miller Bison Kill Site for our audience? Like, what's the age? Where are we at? And its importance in Plains Paleo-Indian archaeology.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you said, it's located in the tri-state area, right where the corners of Nebraska, Kansas, and Colorado, as they're known today, meet. It's out on the plains, and it dates amazingly to about 11,800 years ago. The bison recovered from this kill site are Bison antiquus, so they're about 25% larger than modern-day bison. They did exhibit signs of butchery as well as carnivore gnawing, and they were recovered with stone tools, very importantly, over 200 stone tools that come from a wide variety of regions and areas around where the kill site was located. So it's really important. It was found in the early 70s by the local family that works the land. They're still the people that ranch and farm on that land today. The Jones family, which is where the Jones part of Jones Miller comes from. They were extending a field of theirs in 72 for irrigation and came across, cut into this bone bed, and reached out to a friend of theirs, Miller, the other part of the name, who came out to take a look at the site in 72 and quickly discovered the size and the extent of the bones there were just beyond the scope of what he knew in his limited archaeology experience. So long story short, he reached out into his network and Dennis Stanford ended up coming out to the site to work it through National Geographic. He had just started at Smithsonian and he was there in 73, 74, and 75. And him and his team dug 100% of the site, which is not common practice, but they removed, at the Jones family's request, 100% of the site.
So what's fascinating about the site for a number of reasons, like one, you know, Dennis Stanford, who is an archaeologist in Smithsonian, as you mentioned, famous guy for a different archaeology, excavated this when he was working for Denver Museum of Nature and Science. One of my favorite parts about going through the archives of that site was looking at the old 1970s, like what 1972 to 1974 were the three excavation periods, if at least. Looking at the old field crew photos and noticing Marcel Kornfeld and Kathy Cameron when they're like teenagers, early 20s, and seeing the handwritten notes for people across the country asking Dennis if they could join his field program back in the day where you had to write a letter. And, you know, like today people get stressed about having 5 minutes to write an email and get it off in time for the deadline. Back then it was like having to account for postal, you know, like making sure it gets, and it was just wild, a different time. But also the site's really cool because it's this massive bone bed, like hundreds of thousands, if not at least like a million pieces of bones on top of the lithics that are present. And it's on top of a, not a bluff, but it's not in the creek drainage. Like it's above the creek or the arroyo where you'd expect a bison kill to be, which has led to like, why are they here? Were they drug up from the arroyo? That's a lot of bison to drag up. Bison antiquus, 1.5 times the size of modern bison. That's a big old cow. What's going on? So it's 100% excavated. Dennis Stanford's going back there for at least 3 field seasons, has all these plucky young archaeologists that later have amazing careers into the field in various ways. What's the significance?
Well, it's, you know, like you mentioned, for one part, launched a lot of folks' careers. I was at the Plains Conference with my colleague, Natalie Patton, who also worked on this project with us at Denver Museum of Nature and Science. And we met folks that had, you know, worked at the site, which was just wonderful and interesting in its own right. But yeah, the site location is, of course, it's been modified today, but it is not where you would think to find bison kill. It's not off a cliff. It's not an arroyo. So the thought is that within the center of the site, there was a post hole. And Dennis Stanford made some hypotheses about what this post hole was there for. I myself don't particularly subscribe to his hypotheses. I've had a few conversations with Natalie again about what that was there for. And there's some interesting ethnohistoric work that has been done on bison drives. So since there's not a natural landmark or natural landscape where these bison would be, you know, driven to or driven off of, something that makes a lot more sense to me is the working hypothesis that Natalie shares, that is that a pen was built and that the bison were driven into this space. Additionally, there's evidence because of a couple different strings of evidence. We've done some carbon 14 dating. There's also tooth eruptions in the mandibles for the juvenile bison at the site. We know that there's multiple kill events there, so the site is being revisited. And it's also important to note, too, that Stanford and his team, for those 3 years that they were there, put a lot of time and effort into taking a look around the site to see if there was any evidence of any towns or camps. And not saying that it wasn't there, because again, it's agricultural in nature now, so that evidence could have been destroyed or just not found. But they didn't find any evidence of anyone living there permanently. So the site being revisited is probably relatively significant.
Right. And in terms of like going towards how much time and effort was put into this site, like Waldo Wadle, who is one of the most famous Plains archaeologists, you know, in 1986, you know, he states that Jones Miller was the most carefully studied bison kill site that he knew of. And like, I agree with you. So, I mean, I guess for context, you know, Dennis Stanford has since passed. And I guess we can get into the history of like how we ended up with having to work on this site in a bit, but you know, he found this post hole and his hypothesis was, well, maybe it's a hunting totem, and he used ethnographic evidence of like the Assiniboine and Crow. They have something, but like I'm on the same wavelength as you guys, because we know through the dating that we did and that we got to publish on, is that there's multiple kill events, and that with ethnographic history, especially with Plains Indians who don't have positive topography, like in the Front Range, to do kill drives into bison jumps, you make corrals, you turn the arroyos and the negative topography into drive lanes, and you create kill zones that way. And like, especially we see repeated use, which we can see through the Bayesian, which is what I did. We can see clear kill events, like at least two, that people are coming back, and this is a great spot to do it. And we can see the ethnographic record from other Plains Indians who did the same thing using certain arroyo or valley features in a particular way. And also on top of that, right, it's a hell gap. It's known for having hell gap points. You know, this is one of the early, it's hell gap and agate basin points too, is what?
Correct. Yep.
Yeah. So we have two Paleo-Indian complexes that we know today do show up at the same time together at certain places. But for the 70s, this is like one of the first hell gap sites outside of hell gap, the hell gap, mm-hmm. that are finding these points. And I think as the crow flies, I don't think they're that far apart from each other, right? I'm going to Google Maps it.
It's my understanding, too, that this is the only site as well in the modern state of Colorado that does have hell gap projectile points, but you would be the expert on that.
Vaguely. I mean, people give me, I think, you know, Steve Nash, our previous overlord. I guess your current overlord still, right? He's at Archaeologist Southwest. Yeah. I think he gave me too much credit about how I knew about hell gap. So as the crow flies, it's a 246-mile drive, but that's going due north and then northwest to Guernsey. But I think,
yeah,
if we were to walk it, I don't know. Yeah, it's about like,
it's about 280 miles on my map.
Yeah. If you're driving it following roads, like point to point, probably a little less, but
sure,
it's a hike. And I think the raw material too, like there was like Hartville Uplift, which is, you know,
yep,
from that area. So it's a whole deal.
Yeah. There's Wyoming, Colorado, Kansas, South Dakota, Texas, all represented in the raw material of the stone tools. So
right.
Hypotheses on that as well.
100%. Like it has like some of the best stone material found across the Great Plains 11,000 years ago, right after the end of the Ice Age. It's like, what? It's like, how do these people get here? How'd they get this stuff? Like, it's pretty, these people were out and about or trading with other folks out and about. But yeah, so when, I'm trying to think who was on the project. It was me, then you, we had Natalie Patton. Mm-hmm. We have to have Natalie on the show at some point. Yeah. And you worked on it longer than I did because I just had that summer internship. And then I was only as the research assistant for like 6-7 months before I got the tenure gig. And then you were there for a little bit longer.
Yeah. So I ended up spending just short of 2 years on the project, which is massive. But yeah, it was that first 6 months we worked together. And then I stayed on for about another year and 3-4 months after that.
Yeah.
And that was, we can get into it, you know, a little bit more, but that was working with the collection itself and how it came to us from Smithsonian. We can dig into that.
Yes, let's dig into that here in the second. So we'll be right back with Amy after these messages. And welcome back to episode 32. Here with Amy, talking about Jones Miller. So the site was excavated like 40, 50 years ago by the time we got our hands on it. Amy, for our listeners, how did me, you, and poor Natalie get saddled with working on this collection and for the time that we did?
Yeah, definitely. The Denver Museum of Nature and Science was in an agreement from the very beginning with Stanford and the funders and the Jones family as part of the process, and were the legal custodians of the collection. So the collection has been intended to stay in the state of Colorado the entire time. At the time, the Denver Museum of Nature and Science did not have an adequate storage space for what is estimated to be, 41,000 bones. It was almost 700 2-foot by 3-foot boxes. They were gigantic. It takes up 3 rows of storage space in the anthropology collections. So Stanford arranged to take the collection with him back to the Smithsonian and continue working with it. He was really interested in the butchery and some of the other aspects, and him and his colleagues intended to write manuscripts about the site and various aspects, lithics, the microfauna present, the mollusks that were present, and put this all together into one large manuscript that didn't end up ever coming to fruition. There's various chapters that were written by his colleagues that are all in different states of publication and editing. And as Carlton mentioned, Stanford has since passed away. And at that time, the Denver Museum of Nature and Science and Smithsonian got together to determine if the museum, DMNS, still had an interest in housing the collection that it had legal custody over. And they decided at that time, yes, that was something that would be important to come back to Colorado for various reasons. Stanford and his team had their swing at their analyses and their hypotheses and their publications. And there's a new generation of anthropologists and archaeologists, both at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science and in archaeology in Colorado. So they thought that it would behoove Colorado archaeology to bring the collection back. And they did just that. They took teen science scholars, a wonderful program that they have each summer out in the summer of, I believe it was 2017 or 2018, and boxed up Stanford's collection and brought it back to Denver on a 53-foot semi shipping truck. And then Carlton and Natalie and I were all hired at different points to work with the collection, rehouse it, take a look at it, organize it, get it set up for future research. So since that manuscript never came to publication, how can we get this site out there? You know, when you hear about bison kill sites, it's one of the biggest. It is the biggest in Colorado. It's one of the biggest in the plains. And it just never really saw the light of day that it could have. So some people know about it. It is important. So that's the concept, is to get it open. And that's what we did. We spent a few years getting it rehoused, organized, set up for future research, and invited some graduate students in. Actually, as I was leaving my time at Denver Museum of Nature and Science on that project, two graduate students were working with it and taking a look at a full-scale funnel analysis of two of the excavation squares, which was a tactic and an approach that nobody had taken to that point. So it's exciting to see they're both getting near graduation. I'm excited to see their results and their defenses.
Absolutely. Yeah, I got roped in because I applied to be the Native American science intern one summer. And I got that call from Steve, and he saw that I had worked at Hellgap and pitched this collection. And I was like, sure, because I needed the summer employment. But I was actually really hoping to get collections, like hands-on collections experience, and I didn't have to get research, which is fine. I'm super grateful for Steve and DMNS. But I spent that summer trying to track down where are all the chapters, going through the archives, what state, trying to figure out the figures, which is still a problem of which ones are we supposed to be using, because they're not in the chapters. There's just manila folders for each chapter with the same figure, but 30 different times. It's which one? And same with the tables. Mm-hmm. Who's dead? Who's alive? Getting permission. And, and trying to figure out, do we try to publish this as is, or... because some of the language in there is really dated, not great. And as you mentioned, there's a fair number of people that do know about it. And everyone, and what we heard back was no one cares for the words. Everyone just wants the data. At this point, mm-hmm. we just need the data. Anything from the 70s, no one cares. But we need to know what we're dealing with. And that's why we focused, when I came back as a research assistant, I want to know the dates. And I think Jones Miller is now the second most well-dated site on the Great Plains, because of we got 20 something radiocarbon dates, and that's a publication that we're working on. And me and Amy are going to go to Denver either in December or January. It's completely my fault. We know how old it is. We know what the dates mean, but we need some further information. And then at the time when I was there, Doug Bamforth was having some lithic students look at the lithics, and we learned some more. So just by the fact of Steve and then later Michelle opening this collection back up to the public and inviting archaeologists from Colorado, we have this resource. We're learning a lot more, some newer information about the site that Dennis did publish in it. And in the 90s, it was a quick, this is what mm-hmm. it is, but mm-hmm. All the data never got out. So mm-hmm. It's important. And it's just kind of, I thought it was really cool seeing that much material and just those old excavation units. Cause the blocks mm-hmm. were 2 feet by 2 feet. They weren't even meters, right? It was some goofy metric.
They were meters. They yeah. were 2 meters by 2 meters. And
yeah,
it was a grid system of access was 100 through 112 or 113. And then Y axis was A through O. So it was like A101, A102, and they were all 2 meter by 2 meter, just these massive excavation blocks. It was a huge undertaking.
The amount of bones. And like for like normal archaeologists that are used to seeing like excavations, they assume, like, oh, that grid's one by one. It's like, no, that's a 2x2. Like your eyes are playing tricks on you.
One of the things that we haven't mentioned too, for those that don't know, there's a few different approaches that folks have taken to MNI at the site. One of the MNIs is about 125 Bison Antiqua. Stanford worked under 300 MNI. So, I mean, it's deep too. It's in some spaces a meter deep. It is just this mass concentration of bone.
Yeah. And I can't remember that there's not much stratigraphic difference, right? Like it's all pretty much in the same stratigraphic layer.
Yeah. Yeah. So that, you know, for me raised questions, it's kind of in a little bit of a, when you look at a profile, it's in a little bit of a shallow basin. So I've always wanted to ask questions about, you know, if it's the original processing location, if it's been moved. 11,800 years is a long time. So
right.
Was this the processing location? But then again, you know, there is people with the people that are working, the students that are working on the site now, they're looking at different locations, some closer to the edge, some closer to the center of the kill site, and looking at things that would lend towards hypotheses of if it has been placed into a secondary context or not. Like carnivore gnawing, is there more carnivore gnawing on the outside? Is the inside protected? How is that set up? So it's interesting. There's a lot to be, you know, found out about the site still as well. So I'm glad and grateful that we're still taking a look into it and working with it and talking about it.
Absolutely. You know, people bother me all the time. Like I saw Lee Bennett at Plains the other week. And Lee's like, you know, I was just sitting with him.
He's great.
He was like, whatever happened to Jones Miller? Didn't I write you that introduction? I'm like, yes, you did. You wrote me a very great introduction to the revised manuscript. I was like, it will get published. I promise. Like, something will come out of it, Lee. Yes, I promise you.
We got towards the end. We realized, I think, when you were still there, we had conversations about the scope and that it was really two projects. One was digitizing the archives and doing the work that you were doing in research, reaching out to folks, talking to folks, looking at the different chapters. And then there was the collections rehousing side of it. So there were two projects really kind of running simultaneously. And when you took your tenured gig, that part slowed down and the collections part ramped up, which is great because we got the collection rehoused within the time that we had for the grant funding. And we do know that we want to publish and continue on working with it, and that there's a definite need for it for sure. We could spend some time with it and get that information out there.
Maybe we do like a special issue in Plains. That way we can keep Lee's intro. Awesome. Yeah, we could keep Lee's intro. We could do the radiocarbon. We could do the lithics because, like, we know there's at least two kill events. Yeah, we know there's two kill events. And as you said in the first segment, there's stone raw material from different areas, and something I've always been curious about are different kill events associated with different stone tool material. Like, can we actually track processing areas? And that's why we also need the records of, like, well, where are all the points being found? Like, is there a separation between Agate Basin and Helgat? Because they do overlap, but the time periods that we've seen, one dips more into Helgat, the other dips more into Agate Basin a little bit. And so, like, there's so much we can do once we go back and find the provenience information. That we kind of have a basic one with the mandibles that we use to date, because it, you know, the catalog system's like what C101 dash whatever their unit number is. So we have like a basic where the mandibles came from, but we need the stratigraphic data on top of that. And I need to see the old map. So I think it's fun. I'm very happy that we're still continuing to work on it, because people do ask. And it was in my job talk, and my colleagues at KU are like, so whatever happened to Jones Miller? I'm like, yeah, whatever happened to Jones Miller? That's a great question. I should make a call.
I love that. No, I think a special issue of Plains would be a really great idea, because, you know, we could tie in other folks like Natalie and, you know, the other folks that worked with that collection, the grad students, if they want to speak about their findings. I mean, we could talk about generations at this point, so we should talk about that more. That's a really good idea.
Yeah, because the grad students that are currently working, they could do like preliminary findings from ongoing research on Jones, but like, so it's not blowing their diss out wide open, but they could allude to some things, but just enough to get like a plain special issue out, I think would be neat.
I like it. Let's work on it.
I agree. So how does reexamining the Jones Miller site, how does this contribute to broader conversations about not only paleo Indian archaeology, but also like the ethics of stewardship of these archaeological materials, right? Because we're in with, as your role in NAGPRA, one of the things that we hear a lot from like descendant communities of all backgrounds is, what's the point of your discipline when all you do is dig it out of the ground and put it in a box for 50 years and no one looks at it?
Sincerely. Something I really respected with the start of this was that the curators and staff at DMNS already had strong relationships with tribes from their work at the Magic Mountain site near Golden, Colorado. So when they started talking about bringing Jones Miller back and working it into the collection at the museum, they reached out to those folks and, you know, tapped into those relationships to talk about, well, this is Paleo-Indian, what's your input, what are your thoughts? And got a lot of endorsements and a lot of support. The answer kind of across the board was, you know, this isn't something that we specifically would like to claim, but we're interested and we'd like to hear your findings. So I thought that was wonderful, because I've had experiences with Paleo-Indian topics where modern tribes are not consulted. So I thought that was unique and interesting, and I'm glad that they did that. But, you know, just being able to take the time to really revisit the collection, the folks that worked at the site in the 70s, Stanford and his team genuinely cared about the collection. They cared about the work that they did. You know, it shows in their passion. It shows in the fact that people are still asking about it and talking about it today. The folks that are going to Plains Conference and wanting to know, you know, I was there, I heard about that. I had a friend that worked there that summer, you know, tell me what's going on with it. Just giving it the time and space to revisit it, take a look at it again, you know, just one, you know, aside, there were items listed as bone tools. And we had a wonderful colleague come out, Christina Burke, and take a look at those for any use wear. And there wasn't any. And that was Marcel Kornfeld's suggestion that we revisit the bone tools, because he said, like, quote unquote, everything, we hold everything a bone tool in the 70s. So, you know, all these items like that were, everything that was labeled as a bone tool, you know, we re-examined and took a look at again and said, well, we don't see any use wear on them. So we're going to suggest that they're not bone tools. It's just breakage patterns. So just being able to take the time to take fresh eyes and take a look at it and talk about it and get that data out there, you know, it's important and necessary, and it helps contribute to the broader picture of what it is that we are trying to understand in anthropology and archaeology, and give it the time and the respect that it deserves, as well as, you know, the concept that I myself am non-Indigenous, so I won't speak to it directly, but colleagues of mine that are Indigenous have spoken about faunal collections. Chance Ward is coming to mind, you know, being respected in ways that they're treated as ancestral remains, and how should faunal collections be treated in museum settings? That's important too. So having experienced unpackaging and rehousing this gigantic faunal collection changed my perspective in my own work, working with folks like this and hearing these conversations and talking about these things, that, you know, there's more ways of thinking than, you know, the way that I was brought up in anthropology and archaeology. So I was grateful for that as well.
Man, Chance Ward, real sacred, that guy. One of my favorites. Well, excellent.
Yeah,
excellent. He's just at History Colorado. He didn't move too much. So, Amy, thank you so much for being on. I'm so happy we got to talk about Jones Miller. This has been a really fun episode to talk about. I'm excited to meet up with you at DMNS and tie up this project and get it out and get the attention it deserves, especially before like Ken, Marcel, Kathy Cameron, and others who work there are no longer with us.
Yeah.
Where can our listeners contact you if they have any questions, whether about Jones Miller, Archaeology Southwest, or maybe even guidance with NAGPRA?
Absolutely. Yeah. The best way to reach me is at a really long email address. It's nagpra@archaeologysouthwest.org. Archaeology does have an A E-O in the middle of it. We spell it the that way. But that's a great way to reach out to me. And I would be happy to talk about any of these things. Like I said, you know, I have experience across the board. I currently work in Peruvian archaeology as well. So it's...
That's right. You went with
Michelle. I am working in Indian archaeology a bit as well. So, I mean, I am passionate about this stuff. I love talking about it, especially for folks that are early career and just starting out and have questions and want to know, you know, anything. Feel free to reach out.
Sounds great. So with that, everybody, I will also throw Amy's email in the show notes, as well as two YouTube videos that we did for DM&S, one with me, one with Amy. Forgive my COVID beard. I look at some of those old 2020, 2021 videos where my beard is like Gandalf length, and I'm like, I can't believe I allowed it to grow that much.
It was the look at the time, though. Everybody did it. It
was so gross. But yes. And your patriarchy, your not profile pic, your bio page on Archaeology Southwest, and sure, a citation for like the only publication on Jones Miller from Dennis. So for anyone interested, all that's there. And until then, I will see you guys on the next episode.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you so much, Amy. Toodles. Thank you for listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. You can follow me on Instagram at Pawnee_archaeologist, and you can also email me at greatplainsarcpodcast@gmail.com. And remember, anybody can love the mountains, but it takes a soul to love the prairie. American author Willa Cather.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.